Okay. Is everybody ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Let me get in a character.
All right. Welcome to the Film Experience. I am here with my co-host, Murtada El Fadl.
Hello, everyone.
And I am Nathaniel R., of course. And we have a special guest today. Professor, critic, editor, member of the Florida Film Critics Circle, Alfred Soto.
Top of the morning to you all.
And Alfred, you have been with us before for a supporting actress SmackDown.
Correct. The June SmackDown. 1994, was it?
It was, yes. The SmackDowns will be returning.
Yay!
So readers are always asking, but we really can't do them during Oscar season because it's just... there's too much. To quote Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights, too many things, too many things, too many things.
Don't speak.
Taking us back to 1994 again, Alfred.
The Wonder Wheel.
Okay, so I thought we'd start today discussing the Screen Actors Guild nominations. We won't go into too much detail because people might be talked out of them. And I have been bitching too much, so I thought I would turn it over to you, Murtada, first.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am the one who's been, you know, who I always, you know, rages against SAG. So how are you feeling about the nominations a week later?
Well, you know, when I was watching the reading of the nominations on TV, I don't think I heard anything after I realized that Regina King's name wasn't called. And that was so early in the film nominations. So it only dawned on me later, a couple of hours, that, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody was nominated for cast. So I was still in like, oh my God, how could they not nominate Regina? But I will talk about like the good things that I really loved. I think people who are listening to this podcast know that I've been a fan of Joan David Washington's performance in Black Klansman all year. So he got the Globe, now he got the SAG. So I'm happy for that. It seems like he is on his way, or maybe not, but it still was a good get for him and a happy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Black Klansman getting the cast was a good thing. I think the surprising thing was before the nomination, I thought Best Supporting Actress was sort of coalesced on the five in the Globe. But what the SAG told us is that the category that seems sort of set right now is Best Actress and not Best Supporting Actress, and they threw a wrench into Best Supporting Actress. So that's actually fun and exciting that that category is now open.
Fun. I'm not sure I would use the word fun when it's 60% leading roles. But what are you going to do? How about you, Alfred?
Well, I suppose we should get used to seeing Vice popping up.
Have you seen that yet?
I sure have. I'm not sure whether to post thoughts now or wait till another chapter. But it's the sort of film that the industry congratulates itself into thinking it's a marvelous piece of political satire. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that Ethan Hawke is more vulnerable than his precursor wins would lead us to believe. And then finally, Emily Blunt, A Quiet Place, supporting, really?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Especially because she's also nominated for leading actress, so it's really beyond generous to give her two leading nominations in one year.
Yeah.
I mean, one would suffice. You could pretend it's for both if you really loved both performances.
On the other hand, I suppose, and maybe Murtada will disagree, but the supporting actor category seems like this is it, right? More or less, even with that Chalamet category fraud?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think you're right. Maybe the supporting actor is also one that is sort of set on those five. Except if, you know, somebody from Vice rises up, and I'm with you on that one. I hope nobody from Vice gets any nominations.
In fact, the whole cast should be ridiculed by liberals like the Trump administration's cabinet members have been at restaurants.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. I thought you weren't going to post your thoughts about Vice just yet.
Sorry. Sunday morning.
I mean, we're not supposed to say anything about it until sometime tomorrow, so I don't know. Monday. I don't know when this podcast is.
If needs be, I will put it up at midnight tonight. That will count.
It's Australia.
I did not like Vice either. And I do agree it's the type of thing people will congratulate themselves for liking.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't, you know, some people think the performances are terrible. I didn't think that. Although they do occasionally skirt the lines of, like, sketch comedy, you know, like, mimicry. I just didn't care for it. It just seemed easy to me. Although it does have a few inspired comic moments, I think.
I think the script is not very good, especially at the end when, you know, we don't want to give anything away, but it spends way too much time on this sort of MacGuffin, you know. There is a sort of cameo narrator story, and then you're like, what is he doing? And then by the end, it becomes this big thing, and the movie spends way too much time on that narrator story. Then I was, like, ready in a story of Dick Cheney, and I'm like, what is happening? That's when I completely lost. I was just like, okay, I don't like this movie at all.
That's a lot of build-up for what little payoff there is, yes.
And totally, it just really offended me. When, I don't know if we should reveal what happens in the last third. I mean, it's part of history right now, you know, when Liz Cheney runs for the congressional seat in Wyoming and suddenly there's a drama in the family, Liz versus Mary. I mean, it's just unearned. Where's this coming from? Is this supposed to, quote-unquote, deepen his character? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is history, so not really a spoiler. Everybody knows the movies about the Cheneys, but there was drama within the family about sort of throwing the lesbian daughter under the bus.
Right.
For political gain. And I did, that was another thing that felt unearned to me, because it spent a lot of time trying to humanize them around the issue of gay rights, only to, you know, I mean, it's historical, whatever, that part's true, but it just, yeah, the movie felt to me like a mess with a couple brilliant moments that are going to convince people that the whole movie is brilliant.
It also feels like, you know, Adam McKay sort of congratulating himself about knowing more about the Cheneys than anybody else, or about what they did to fuck up the world, which I think we all knew. So there is a sort of like glib tone to the whole enterprise that just doesn't fit well.
Yeah, I'm kind of dreading a Best Picture nomination when there's so many great films that seem to be on the cusp that it will block. But what are you going to do?
I mean, it is coming in for a critical drubbing, right? The reaction to it from the critics will be very divisive, because they've been moving the embargo date. Like, they moved it twice because they are a little afraid of what the critics are going to say, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think once you dig your track into award season, it's really hard to dislodge you, which is honestly why a lot of movies wait this long to open, because they want to control the conversation for as long as they can. So once people are convinced you're a contender, they sort of don't usually throw you away. but we'll see. We have seen in the past some late breakers get thrown away if people were suddenly like, wait, that wasn't so good. Anybody remember Nine, the musical?
Oh, yes. And Confessions of a Geisha.
Memoir.
Oh, Memoirs of a Geisha.
Sorry, Memoirs of a Geisha.
I was like, I want to hear this geisha confessing.
Yeah.
I'd be up for that.
Oh, boy.
So, like, last year, that Phantom Thread came in late and then, like, really surprised. But that was because it's a movie that people loved.
Yeah.
I don't think people are going to love Vice that much.
Yeah, that's the difference. It's, like, late breakers who people suddenly realize, oh, my God, this is great, is a little different than late breakers who are only trying to break late enough to not be questioned.
Right.
Which is what, you know, several movies do each year.
But this is brings us back to SAG, if we're still talking about that. Do we think, is that why Beale Street did not get any nominations there? It's a sort of a late release, even though it basically went to a lot of festivals, but also the screener wasn't sent in time. I mean, this is some of the things that I was reading as justification for why Beale Street missed at SAG.
Yeah,
or that
I mean,
they did.
I think that's part of the reason, and I think that's why The Post missed last year, because it's such an easy type of Screen Actors Guild nomination. And you could even say the same thing of Vice this year, because not to judge awards voters, but people are kind of likely to vote for Christian Bale and Amy Adams without actually watching a movie.
Yeah.
But they're not likely to vote for an entire cast without seeing a movie. Because they can't be like, oh, I love that movie, I'm nominating it for Best Cast, you know?
Yeah. And also, if you, say, receive the two screeners for Vice and Beale Street, one has big stars, one doesn't, maybe that's the one you watch.
Yeah, and also, SAG reminds us every year that that's a much earlier voting process. Which is why, you know, it's a little upsetting that Ethan Hawke didn't figure in. But on the other hand, SAG does lean populist, so I'm not actually worried about Ethan Hawke. I think he's going to get an Oscar nomination.
Yeah. Doesn't he get, like, the Isabelle Huppert
sort
of slot?
I think he's way too many people's number ones to miss. That's what I'm telling myself over and over.
I mean, that's sort of like the playbook, right? She got all the critic wins, the big critics wins, and then didn't get any I mean, she did actually get nominated at the Globe, so he missed that. But otherwise, it was just the Oscars.
Yeah.
Plus, he has two previous acting nominations and a screenplay nomination. So there's this, I guess, sense in which he's one of us now from Academy voters. So
no, he's well liked in the industry, which I think will help him, especially because people who love that performance, again, it's going to be their number one.
And also, I think the Academy is more likely to watch a Paul Schrader movie than SAG.
Yes.
Like, they know, so they will watch that screener.
Yeah. And even if they turned it off, which you always hear about people turning off screeners, God forbid, he's impressive right from the beginning. So
right.
It's not like they're going to miss the performance if they don't love the movie. So, any thoughts about Bohemian Rhapsody that are not, how could this happen? Because I already covered that.
I don't want to keep talking about Bohemian Rhapsody. That's the only thought I have.
Oh, that you don't want to keep talking about it?
Yes, which unfortunately we have to, because it seems like it's going to factor in awards.
Yeah, it's the one movie I've had a lot of arguments about on social media and in person. The real disjunction between critical response and popular acclaim. And I get really befuddled looks when I say how much I hated that movie. So I suppose we critics are the outliers.
Yeah. I just don't even understand, like, the gay response to it. Because whenever I say that I think it's homophobic, like, people freak out at me. Like, how could you say that? And I'm just like...
Gay people?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I'm like, it is, like, the whole visual choices, everything is like, ew, gay in that movie.
Yeah.
I know I'm not supposed to be broadly judging people, but that's easy to do during awards season. I think it's telling that the movie is that popular, and I think that the homophobia helps.
Mm-hmm. I also think people, like, unfortunately, don't think about movies anymore as deeply as they should before just voting for them. Because if, you know, this is the same thing that I noticed with Vice, with Green Book, with Bohemian Rhapsody. It's just people take the thing at its surface.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really allow yourself to think a little bit about what these movies are doing or what they're trying to do, they will not be your favorite of the year. So,
right.
So maybe that's why.
I mean, I just want people to think, you know, people are like, you know, get mad at me for saying it's homophobic. I just want them to think of how it introduces the gay content. And how the whole setup is that he's lured into this awful, decadent life. But he's really just a sensitive soul. I mean, it just lays it on thick, the heteronormativity. And yeah, just...
No, go ahead. No, and at any rate, it doesn't matter because all this is transcended when he goes to Live Aid and universalizes Queen's appeal.
Yeah.
He can woo hetero and queer audiences worldwide.
I really don't like that movie.
I mean, it looks like Zach Greedy loves big hits, right?
Yeah.
Like, all the movies they nominated, even if you go to supporting actress like Quiet Place, or and especially in the ensemble category, it's all movies that, you know, a lot of people have seen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's important to remember that the SAG nominating committee changes every year, which is why it's a little hard to predict what they're going to do. So it's a different, you know, 2,000 people every year, and they're all spread out because SAG has like 90,000 members or something. Well, even more now that it's SAG-AFTRA. So there are people from all over the place. It's not LA-based like a lot of the other awards.
Mm-hmm. And also, doesn't that mean that its correlation with the actors branch in the Academy is less? If it changes every year, it's not the same people.
Right. And it's people are always trying to say, well, the actors felt this way. And I'm like, but the Academy has 9,000 members now, something like that. And the actors branch is like, I think, 2,500 of those or something. And, you know, that's just SAG has like over 100,000 members. And they're randomly selecting 2,000. Chances of them also being Academy voters are not that high. You know?
Yeah.
But it is a general feeling, you know? That's what happens with these things. And since they get so much press, it's like people who aren't thinking through their ballots are like, oh yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody was fun.
Oh my god, look at that woman. She's playing Elizabeth I again. I really love that character. Yeah. What's her name? Margot Robbie. I'm putting her in. I love the history of Elizabeth I.
So, let's move away from SAG. I do have to ask a really quick question about Florida, Alfred.
Uh-huh.
When do you guys vote?
We vote this week, the end of the week.
The end of the week. And are you dreading anything from your fellow Floridians?
It's funny you ask. We've already started the volley of emails between members in which we recommend picks or quash others.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not seeing any trends yet. I have seen a couple of mentions of Chalamet and Malick, but no talk yet about picture, director, the big categories. But I expect that to intensify starting tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Because tomorrow is our deadline, our viewing deadline.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I have a few more things to watch by midnight.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Alfred, who won your best picture last year?
Last year was... Ooh, I have to look this up.
I actually have the page up.
Oh, good.
Since I was going to introduce you earlier. Well, since I did introduce you earlier. Your winner last year was Dunkirk.
Oh, yes.
With Lady Bird as runner-up.
Right.
And that was also true for your Best Director category.
Yeah, I do remember intense discussions about the Florida Project and Dunkirk. Sometimes we make really bold choices. The Lobster the year before, for instance. You never know.
Do you vote in a room or, you know, by email and ballot or online?
Online.
Okay.
Florida's a big state.
Yeah.
And we're scattered all over the place.
I do think that people who vote in a room, sometimes there's more interesting things that happen because you can tell that sometimes you can tell with the results that they're in the room arguing about things.
Yeah.
Which is definitely true of the LA film critics, for example.
A few of us do get together, the ones who are local, and discuss nominations, and sometimes that helps. And yeah, it's harder to have intense personal arguments when you're seeing the person face to face.
Yeah. Well,
which
for
can
some
happen
people. Some
yeah.
people live for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to the new movies of the week. Ben is Back. Let's start there. I have mixed feelings about this, so I'm eager to hear other people, because I'm not sure I have a strong reaction either way to it. There were parts I liked, parts I found annoying. I couldn't decide if it was too slight or just right in terms of very condensed. But I liked Julia Roberts a lot. So that's my non-hot take hot take.
I think I'm with you on Julia. Do you mean condensed? Because the story is, you know, it's all in one night, Christmas Eve, where Ben comes back to his family from the facility that he was recuperating from his opiate addiction, and basically throws a wrench into everybody's life, his mom, his sister, his stepdad. They go on like an odyssey, a car odyssey for half the movie, which I was like, what is going on? But yeah, Julia's fantastic. I loved her too.
Yeah.
I also had a middling response, and that's one of those movies that's hard to remember a few days later. And it's also, to an extent, it's both comforting and tiresome that we see this movie year after year. You know, that Lost Weekend, Days of Wine and Roses, star turn of the addict, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did like Julia Roberts a lot. She's that charm she always knew how to calibrate has gotten more and more honed.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a real presence now. I'm still on the fence about Lucas Hedges, though, what he projects on screen. He's hard to figure out, isn't he? I'm not sure if what he's doing he's completely in control of, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, Alfred. I don't think he's doing anything. He is going for minimalist, but I don't know if it's minimalist because I get nothing from him. I got nothing from him in Boy Erased and even in this movie, which I think he did a little bit more than Boy Erased because he had to do more the character, but still, he's a complete blank slate, and maybe he just wants us to project whatever we think we should project onto his face. And that sometimes works with some actors, but he leaves me cold all the time. I did like him in Lady Bird, but not since then.
I mean, I think the Boy Erased performance might be not helping people to see this performance because I think he's doing a lot more in this one. And I agree that he has to, but the Boy Erased, I just have to chalk that up into the movie. That the movie makes its central character kind of a cipher.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a lot for him to contribute to that unless he was really, really in control, which is, you know, what we're arguing about, I guess, with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because my whole thing with Boy Erased is I like the movie, but I think it really doesn't quite know what it wants to be, because I think secretly it really wants to be a drama about parents.
Absolutely.
And I think if it was that fully, it would be critiqued a lot by people saying, how dare you marginalize the gay character in a gay story, but I think it would be a better movie.
I had the same response to Boy Erased, Nathaniel, as you did about Bohemian Rhapsody. The queer erasure really got under my skin.
Mm-hmm.
And that the editing and cinematographic choices just were in such a way as to say, ew, why are you looking at that boy that way? And the movie unwittingly took the side of the parents and the counselors.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's a tangent.
No, I mean, it's it's central to what we're talking about, but I don't actually think Boy Erased is as judgmental about those things. I think it's trying to come to grips with those things in a way that, like, Bohemian Rhapsody is very much taking the viewpoint of the straight band members whose lives were destroyed by their gay superstar in their midst, by him dying, basically. Them losing, like, their whole, you know, careers, basically. I mean, they're still all wealthy, of course, because Queen's one of the best-selling artists of all time, but still.
Yeah.
I felt a lot of resentment watching Bohemian Rhapsody about Freddie Mercury.
So tell me, Nathaniel, what you liked about Lucas and Ben is Back.
Everybody's putting me on the spot lately. Just let me have my opinions without explaining them. I'm just kidding. I hate it when people can't explain their opinions. I just remember watching it that there was a certain amount of internal drama, and this goes back to the question of minimalism, that the performance felt like someone who was in a lot of pain and not able to share that pain.
Hmm.
There was a certain intensity of the interiority that I really responded to. I didn't think it was a great performance, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying he should be up for Best Actor, no. But I do think it's a lot better than the performance in Boy Erased, which to me felt very hesitant, like he wasn't sure how to play the character.
Mm-hmm. But how lucky is he to have both Nicole Kidman and Julia Roberts as his mom in 1 year?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I really love Julia in that, and I love sort of, she had the big homage to Shirley MacLaine in terms of endearment. Basically, they recreated the Give My Daughter the Shot scene,
yeah.
This time in a police station, and that was my favorite of the, and she, just seeing her face to what Alfred was saying earlier about honing her charm, just seeing her face and her smile, which is so, so familiar to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seeing it in this sort of context of this worried mother was really something great. I thought it's really a fantastic performance from her.
Yeah, when addiction affects a person as intelligent and vivacious as Julia Roberts, it affects us more personally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I will say one more thing about Lucas' performance, and maybe I'm projecting having had experience with, not my own, but loved ones' addictions. Which is, again, like Boy Erased, I think it's more interested in the person affected by the central character than the central character. There was a certain amount of delusion in Lucas Hedges' performance that I liked. Like, you got the feeling that he was always looking for the quick fix, even not so much as drug addiction, like, oh, as long as I do this, the problem will be solved. You know, which sets them off on that whole odyssey, which strains credulity a bit, the plot line. But I got the feeling there was like that sort of rush, this will fix things, you know, and replacing the drugs with, you know, whatever the new task is.
Mm-hmm. Mother love.
What did you guys think of that odyssey? Because I think it was set up to be something that, you know, and sorry if this is a spoiler, there's going to be something more than what it actually ends up being. So to me, that's why, one of the reasons why I don't think the movie works is that they set it up that so many things are going to happen when they go looking at night and they lose the car and all these things happen to them. You were suddenly in a thriller and then it sort of ends with a whimper.
Hmm.
They felt like narrative contrivances. It's undercutting the harrowing nature of addiction for me to suddenly go into these plot lines that are what intended to deepen what is already a pretty fraught situation. Mm-hmm. After a while, just thought, where's this movie going? Why should we care where it's going?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to your point, it was deeper when it was just the effects of his addiction on his immediate family. That was, like, more interesting to see the family dynamics as opposed to this thriller of, like, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, yeah, that's It's definitely problematic in that way. It feels like too effortful. It's almost like the thing where you want to build, if you're going to do a drama about someone's personal hell, which addiction is, you know, then you need to, I think the plot needs to stem from your character study as opposed to a plot, like ladled on top of a character study.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar problem with Beautiful Boy, and, you know, sometimes in my mind I splice the titles together, you know, Beautiful is back, Boy is back.
Beautiful Erased.
Beautiful Erased. In that earlier movie, I couldn't understand why we had to keep moving away from the central drama of the addict. Why does Steve Carell matter? And I know it's based on two memoirs, but it's like Boy Erased is a certain timidity about dealing with a problem at hand, so let's follow Hollywood conventions to get rid of the problem.
Mm-hmm. So none of us
I love Beautiful Boy. And actually what I loved about it is a little in opposition to what you were saying, Alfred, because it's about when you love someone and you're trying to save them and maybe you can save them, like that. That affected me a lot, and I saw Steve Carell was just fantastic. But I know I'm like a minority. I have yet to meet somebody who likes Beautiful Boy.
Which is why I don't actually think that Timothée Chalamet is safe. Like, people keep thinking he's safe for the Oscar nom, and I'm not sure. Because he's the only element of it that people are talking about, and sometimes when you're the only thing to recommend a movie, you fall out at the last minute.
So, readers, if you've seen Beautiful Boy and you love it, please let us know in the comments, because I don't want to feel alone in the world.
Utterly alone.
Yes, readers, give Murtada a collective hug.
Yeah, I won't grill you, since we've already talked about this a lot on this podcast, but I won't grill you about why you liked Beautiful Boy and not Ben is Back, because I think they're doing the exact same thing.
I thought Beautiful Boy was just a little bit deeper, and like, it was like, my problem with Ben is Back was this, the second half, which the thriller elements, which you don't get in Beautiful Boy, which is firmly about what addiction does to a family.
But there is a car chase in Beautiful Boy. That's a thriller element. I'm just kidding. The car chase is actually one of the best scenes in the movie.
Yes.
Because it's just it is out of nowhere, but it feels character driven.
Yes,
I love.
Totally. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I just think Timothée Chalamet, like, if you look, if this is like a parent and a child, Julia's amazing. Mm-hmm. Love her performance. But I think Steve Carell is also good. But if you look at the performance of the children, like, Timothée Chalamet is just bounds ahead of Lucas Hedges. Such a great performance. Now we need to get Timothy and Julia together. That should be the next one.
Well, Julia is good at playing a screen mom, as we mentioned in the last podcast. Okay, we should move on to Beale Street. I am, as everybody knows now, because I mentioned a few times, I am the Beale Street agnostic. So speaking of feeling utterly alone during award season, I'm struggling. Like, everyone loves this movie, and I just don't feel anything except for from Colman Domingo and Regina King. I love everything to do with the parents in that movie. I love their performances. I love the whole family dynamic. I love Regina's whole solo mini arc within the movie when she goes to Puerto Rico. But I just didn't feel anything about the central characters, like, because I felt all that Barry Jenkins gave them to do was to stare at each other. So I'm the agnostic about Beale Street. I wanted to love it. I've seen it twice trying to love it. I just don't.
So I love it. It's one of my top movies of the year. I love every moment of it. And I'll answer, maybe I have a point about when you said the lovers, he didn't give them anything to do. I think the story is a story of ideas, right? It's a story about what it means to be born and live black in this country. And so that's like, there's a violence to that. And that's the sort of other elements of the plot. So I think the love story had to be this sort of oasis in the middle of all this other violence that's happening to them. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's about them taking care of each other and being so tender with each other the whole time. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of why it worked for me as a framework for all the other things that the movie wants to tell. And I think that's why I actually love it so much, because I think part of it is this very tender love story, and part of it is this sort of violent thing that happens that rocks everybody's life to its core. Mm-hmm. And you had to have the love story be so tender to get how violent everything else is. I mean, it's not real violence, like nobody's shot or anything, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, yeah. Well, when you describe it, I'm like, I get that. So, like, intellectually, I understand the appeal of it, but it's such a, I think it's meant, it feels like it's meant to be, like, an emotional experience. Like, the score, which, out of context, I love the score, but it maybe in the movie it's so heavy, the score. And I just wanted to feel something, but whenever we got back to the couple, which is a lot because they're the main characters, I just, like, the tension of the movie and the sort of dynamism of the movie to me kind of dissipated every time. Like, it's so weird. Like, I've rarely had this experience with the movie because everything surrounding the central couple I love. Like, Brian Tyree Henry is amazing. He has, like, a 10-minute scene that is just incredible.
So incredible. It is the best scene in the movie.
So, like, I kept, every time we, like, moved away from that central couple, I got so invested and I was so into it. I guess it's just, like, screen romances that you either feel them or you don't, I guess. I'm not sure.
What do you think, Alfred?
I am also in Nathaniel's side. I also had a mixed response. I should ask both of you, have either of you read the novel, the James Baldwin novel?
I have, yes. I have read it.
It's a fairly faithful adaptation, would you say, Murtada?
Yeah, it is. And that was one of the things before I saw the movie, I was afraid when the first reactions were about how beautiful it is, and I was just like, that's not what that book is about. It's not a beautiful book. The book is so sad, and it's like a howl of despair. How are these people just saying it's beautiful? But yes, all everything that's in the book is in the movie. You get it.
Yeah. It's also important, when I was watching, it was important for me to understand that the socio-political context was too. I mean, for Baldwin to devote so much of his novel to the romance, between the true romance between this couple, was almost the middle finger to all this white liberal despair over what the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act had done to destabilize those white black relations that they had, this vision of black white relations they had in their own minds. So to write a book around that couple was itself a strong political statement. And for Barry Jenkins to write and direct this adaptation in 2018 is a political statement too. And it's to have a movie in which two black actors face the camera and then at each other completely in love, and they're beautiful actors, both of them, is for me, was pretty bold. That said, a lot of the movie felt stilted in ways that reminded me of the things I didn't like about Moonlight. I think this is a more graceful piece of filmmaking than Moonlight, and I look forward to Jenkins's next efforts. But some of the rhythms felt like a non-musical version of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It plotted at times, and I disagree, Murtada, that the Puerto Rico sequence worked. I thought it was a mistake in the novel, too. And when it happens here, I had several friends who hadn't read the book say, you know, what the fuck is happening? You know, how did she get over there? Who is this guy she's talking to?
That was me that loved the Puerto Rico sequence.
Yeah. It also bothered me that none of the actors looked particularly Puerto Rican. They were playing Puerto Rican with Cuban accents, but that's a minor quibble. The family scenes at the beginning, the argument in the apartment, when the two families realize that they're going to be grandparents, that mm-hmm. was beautifully paced and acted. But a lot of the way Jenkins shot New York, while I guess an antidote to the despair that Baldwin wrote about so eloquently in the novel, a lot of it almost felt too unspeakably gorgeous. And I know that was an aesthetic, a conscious decision that Jenkins made, but it puts the audience in this passive position. You know, we're supposed to be enraptured by this couple. And I don't know if it sustained the interest for, what was it, 132 minutes, 140 minutes? It was mm-hmm. a long movie.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I took my best friend who's like really, really into James Baldwin because I thought he would love it, and he didn't love it for similar reasons. Like, he just thought the pacing was like agonizing. I didn't feel that way. Like, it was slow, but I didn't feel like agonized by the pacing. But I'm happy, but I will say this, I'm happy that people are loving the movie, because it's definitely not the kind of movie that we always see. So it, like, I'm so, yeah. so thrilled that Barry Jenkins has a career, and it looks like it's going to be a big career. Because I think he has a unique vision, which is what filmmakers should have if they're going to become major deal filmmakers like him, you know.
As somebody who like loves Baldwin, and Baldwin is you know, more than any writer, I think, just has an effect, has had an effect on my life. Just, you know, somebody I really admire mm-hmm. and read most of his books. And you know, you've been waiting for like a Baldwin adaptation for so many years, and I know it's, you know, the state is sort of like really protective of his books and all mm-hmm. of that. So to actually then see this movie was just such an amazing moment. When you've, I only read Beale Street this year, but I've read, you know, a lot of, almost all of his other books. So mm-hmm. it's just great to see a James Baldwin adaptation on the big screen. It's amazing, I think.
Well, he's very hot right now because he had that very successful documentary last year. And they're adapting something else soon, right? Somebody is.
I haven't heard. I don't know.
It's funny we haven't seen an adaptation of Giovanni's Room yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody get on that. But it's just, this movie was such an emotional experience for me. I love it so much.
No, and that's what it should be. So again, I'm absolutely thrilled that a large portion of people are connecting that way, because I think musicals, I think movies that are meant to evoke these like heightened emotional states in the viewer, I love it when those succeed. I just wish it succeeded for me, that's what I'm saying. Because it is something, like, I really, really want to love it. I just couldn't get there, because I was such a huge fan of Moonlight. I was really excited for this one.
By the way, why isn't Colman Domingo he's not in the conversation. He's fantastic.
He's great in the movie, yeah.
For the Mortada Awards, he's winner of Best Supporting Actor.
Well, he runs circles around Mahershala Ali and Green Book, that's for damn sure.
Yep.
It's such an amazing performance. It's just like you understand, like, to me, the way that he looks at his daughter in that scene, you sort of understand how resilient she is, because she obviously grew up with so much love. It's just, and his chemistry with Regina King, and then he gets that scene with Michael Beach.
Which is another of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, it's just like he's so amazing. Like, this actually leads us to one of the questions that we got from readers, which Colman Domingo was going to be my answer to the question. So, Alfred, maybe you can, maybe it's your answer too, but the question is from Nick. And actually, he says, like, what is an element of a movie in the awards race that is not being talked about, but that you love and that you think should be talked about? So that's Nick T.
Just this movie specifically?
No, in the awards race. So his answer to his question is that, you know, Can You Ever Forgive Me is being talked about for Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy, but he thinks of Dolly Wells and other elements that should also be up for awards. My answer is Colman Domingo. You know, Beale Street is talked about for director, for Regina King, but where is Colman Domingo? He should be in Best Supporting Actor. What's your answer?
Yeah, he is definitely in my... You asked me about the Florida Film Critics. He is top five for me. I mean, he blew me away. And it's rare to see a father-daughter relationship limned so well in a film. Without getting into specifics, it's the performances, the two of them just lock into each other in a way that you can't fake. It just happens without effort. And yeah, that bar scene later in the picture was just wonderful.
Nathaniel, do you have any other answer for this question besides Colman Domingo?
I mean, I'm thinking of it because I'm sure I have one.
While you think about it, I have another answer. If we're also talking about supporting actor, Josh Hamilton in Eighth Grade should be, people are not talking about him.
I really liked him in that, but, you know, I was starting to compile my list, you know, because I end up, with the Film Bitch Awards, I end up doing like a top 12 in every category because I'm a semi-finalist that I list under the nominees or whatever. So yeah. Josh Hamilton is not in my top five, but I do really like that performance. And it is, I guess, a little weird to me to see the movie embraced by a lot of people, but not him so much, because I think he is important to how well Elsie Fisher comes off as well.
Yeah.
But I have another idea, too, on that same tip.
And what is that?
Steven Yeun and Bernie.
Oh. But he is getting attention. He is amazing.
Yeah. He won L.A.
I mean, The Burning is so... Or The Burning. Listen to me. Burning is so good, but I think he is, like, the secret weapon of it, because he just keys into all the things about it that are both seductive and upsetting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if we are on that tack, you know, movies not in English are not being talked about for acting, like Joanna Cooley in Cold War, or Zena Rafia in Capernaum. Like, those are two performances that should be up there, and nobody's talking about them. The movies are being talked about for just foreign language films.
Yeah. Joanna Cooley just won the European Film Awards. But I saw that movie a second time a week ago, and on second viewing, I was like, wow, she's great in this movie. Like, the first time, I was just so enveloped by the look of the movie and the music that I wasn't thinking about the acting so much. But on second viewing, I'm like, if we're going to praise a performance in a foreign language in a beautiful, beautiful movie, I would go with her over Yalitza, who is getting a lot of attention for Roma.
Must you touch that movie again?
You're the lone Roma critic, Alfred. Speaking of being utterly alone, see, we all have something to feel utterly alone about.
It's existential despair at this point. did you want me to discuss it? Or just noting it and moving on?
Do we have any other things to this question? Because I think there's more reader questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nick T also wants us to talk about Best Actress, but basically I think his question is, are McCarthy and Emily Blunt really 4 and 5? Or, I don't know. I mean, I love Mary Poppins Returns. I think it's amazing. But the critics are not in love with it, so I don't know what does that mean for Emily Blunt's chances.
I mean, I think that those five are probably the nominees, but it's important to remember, as it is every year, that the Oscars don't even start nominating until after most of these things take place. So they don't start for another 2 weeks for actually nominating people. So, like, the ballots don't go out until early January. So I think we could still see Nicole Kidman pop up, for example.
Huh.
I'm not predicting it, but I think she's probably in the sixth place right now. So if Emily or Melissa are vulnerable, I would say Nicole is going to dislodge one of them. If they're vulnerable.
I think it's going to be Elissa Aparicio who dislodges anybody, and it's probably McCarthy. Because Emily Blunt is going to be in the number one movie in the country while everyone is voting.
That's true.
I was about to ask about Melissa McCarthy's vulnerability. I haven't shared my opinion of Can You Forgive Her, but I thought that was a marvelous movie and probably the best mainstream queer experience of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great movie. I don't think it's getting enough credit at all.
Then we have a question from Polyvamp, and this question you would love, Nathaniel. She says, if Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone were in category frogging their way to nominations, who do you think would fill in their place? Is given the nominees usually come from Best Picture nominees.
I mean, I still maintain that Linda Cardellini could surprise at the last second without any precursors. Because, sorry, Murtada, but people just really love Green Book. I don't know why, but they just really do. So I could see her surprising still. I mean, I think the five are set now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think Regina King has anything to worry about despite SAG. But
maybe if, you know, if those two actresses were not, you know, in the category.
Right.
So like Elizabeth Debicki might have found her way in and created, you know, some momentum.
I would have liked to have believed that, but for whatever reason, people are just not having widows.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually think Debicki is in the top eight or so, as much as I want to say she is. Because to me, she's like an obvious, like, it's insane to have a ballot of five without her on it. That's what I think. But I think if Stone and Vice weren't there, I think it would be Nicole Kidman and Linda Cardellini. That's what I'm thinking.
Hmm. Interesting.
Do you have any suggestions, Alfred?
I suppose we have to deal with Stone and Vice. As far as, I mean, every year we have category fraud, but this year it's particularly egregious. What with, you know, Chalamet and supporting actor. It would not surprise me if Cardellini, Sunday morning, made it in. But I suppose we also have to reckon with a likely Amy Adams nod. Is she looking firm?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at least she's actually supporting. It's a big role. It's a big role, but it's still a supporting role.
No, it's honestly supporting. I agree.
Okay, our last question is from Rebecca, and this is it's a fun one. If you could reassign an Oscar win throughout history that would then have a cascading effect, what would it be? I think this needs like a 2-hour podcast,
but
we'll try to give a couple of, like, answers. Since I thought about it a little bit, and I'll link it to this year's Oscars, Toni Collette has no chance of being nominated. She should have just won for The Sixth Sense instead of Angelina Jolie. That's who I would give it to. Angelina Jolie, amazing movie star. Her career does not really require an Oscar for acting. She already gets one for an honorary Oscar for her humanitarian efforts, mm-hmm. So that's the one she really deserves, and Tony has an Oscar, and we're all set.
This would require a 2-hour podcast, because the things that initially come to mind for me are kind of one-offs, where it wouldn't really affect things, because the most painful loss to me ever in the history of the Oscars is Judy Garland for A Star is Born. but Grace Kelly had such a short career, even though it's a legendary career, that she would have never, it wouldn't have had a cascading effect at all, because, you know, she wouldn't have won later on, you know?
But your answer fits into this year, too, because this is the year we have another A Star Is Born.
Yeah. Because I will say this, if Lady Gaga pulls off the win, whereas Judy Garland, one of the greatest movie stars of all time, who never won Best Actress, if that's just going to be upsetting to me, any way you slice it.
What about you, Alfred?
I have to think about this. I mean, the classic one that comes to mind is the 1939-1940 Best Actor race. When Jimmy Stewart should have won for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but instead gets it the year later for the Philadelphia Story.
Yeah.
And when you want to think about one critical actor in that movie, the last person you think of is Jimmy Stewart. I think of Cary Grant. And then that way Henry Fonda would have won in 1940 for The Grapes of Wrath, thus saving us from
On Golden Pond.
On Golden Pond.
Wow, that's a great answer. That's very cascading.
Yeah.
For decades.
Yeah, and then probably Burt Lancaster might have won that year for Atlantic City.
Yeah. I mean, I will say one of the things, I don't want this to happen, but if we were rewriting history, you know, a lot of people think that Katharine Hepburn shouldn't have had to share her win for Lion in Winter. A lot of people think that's her best performance. But if Barbara Streisand had lost that year instead of tied her, I think she would have won in 73 for The Way We Were.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that performance is utterly amazing. So that would have been okay with me as a cast.
Who won in 73?
Glenda Jackson.
Her second Oscar.
Oh my.
Her second
Glenda Jackson won
Oscar.
Over Barbara Streisand? I never put those two together. I'm like, mind is blown right now.
Yeah.
And Nathaniel probably knows better than we do. I think that one was really a surprise, right? It was, the audience was legit shocked that Jackson won the second time.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was surprised, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the things that I would, you know, are like cascading. Sorry, the cat is making lots of noise in the room right now, if you heard that listening. A lot of things wouldn't cascade, a lot of my things. Like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. I love Sharon Moonstruck, so I'm not unhappy about that win. But the following year, Jodie Foster versus Glenn Close. Obviously, Glenn Close should have won.
Yes.
But that wouldn't really have a cascading effect because Jodie wins for Silence of the Lambs regardless, you know.
Yeah.
Yes. Although if she hadn't won for Silence of the Lambs, then I think it would have been Susan Sarandon, which frees up 1995, which my preference is Elizabeth Shue in Leaving Las Vegas.
Agreed.
But
I'm happy with Sarandon's win there.
I mean, she was great in that movie, don't get me wrong. She would be my number two that year.
I would have switched the two winners. I would have had Shu win Best Actress and Sean Penn win Best Actor.
Exactly. See, I knew there was a reason I liked you, Alfred. That's the best scenario in that year.
PayPal me my royalties, please.
Well, and also, if Sean Penn had won for that, which is one of his very best performances, there was no reason to reward him for Mystic River, because there were better options that year.
Yes.
Although I have no issue with him winning again in 2008.
Yeah. So as you can see, listeners, we could do this all day long. So why
people
don't
are probably
tell us,
like, let's do that 2-hour podcast.
So tell us in the comments which Oscar you will reassign.
We plan to turn this into a 6-hour Tarkovsky-like experience.
How about a 10-episode thing like Kieslowski?
Ooh.
I'm up for it. Let's do it.
All right. That was a lot. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Alfred Soto for guesting.
Thank you very much.
We're trying to lure Alfred back for more, so please thank him for guesting.
And tell the listeners, Alfred, where they can see where they can find you online.
Sure. I have a blog called Humanizing the Vacuum. That's where you'll find most of my film reviews, and I do a lot of music stuff too.
And you really should, if you haven't yet. I did link to it, but if you haven't read it yet, you really need to read Alfred's review of Roma, because it's really interesting, and it's one of the only pans out there, and you can still read it and still love Roma, as I do, but it's a really interesting review.
Thank you.
And let's tell the listeners where to follow us on social media. So, Alfred?
You can find me at SotoAlfred on Twitter.
And I am at ME_says on Twitter.
And I am at Nathaniel R on Twitter. And because that was not available on Instagram, it's Nathaniel_TFE. TFE obviously being the film experience.
And we really appreciate all your questions this week. That made the episode very fun. So give us more questions for next week.
And I will put up a thread this time, because some of you asked for it, and I'll admit I forgot, a question and answer thread. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week when there's a lot of movies coming out. Mary Poppins Returns!